Today on the 21st, President Obama is a White Sox fan, but he still gave the Cubs a big welcome, even from the Marine Band at the White House yesterday. That's audio recorded by WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout. She joins us. Also, we answer some of the most common and quirky questions about the human body, like, why do people crave terrible food at night?
Your low blood sugar tells you, you need to eat something. So if you go past that point where you shouldn't have gone to bed, people tend to want, I guess, what Taco Bell would sell to you as the fourth meal.
That's Dr. and Atlantic Magazine editor Jim Hamblin. He talks to us about his new book, If Our Bodies Could Talk. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I hope everyone had a safe and happy holiday weekend. For those of you just getting back to work today, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, the World Series champion Chicago Cubs visited the White House, one of President Obama's last official events there, this last week of him being in office. President Obama is a Sox fan, but even he said, like many, he was moved by the historic Cubs World Series win.
I almost choked up listening to it, and it spoke, I think, to how people feel about this organization. And that it's been passed on generation after generation, and it's more than just sports.
WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout was there in Washington. She's back in Chicago now and with us on the 21st. Cheryl, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla.
Such a historic day yesterday, and you were tweeting on Sunday what a historic event it was to have President Obama, the first African-American president, get to host the Cubs. Dexter Fowler, the first African-American player to ever start for the Cubs in the World Series on Martin Luther King Day in the White House. In fact, President Obama even talked about this. I wanted to play this for everyone. He talked about the legacy of people like Jackie Robinson and Mr. Cub, Ernie Banks.
There's a direct line between Jackie Robinson and me standing here. There is a direct line between people loving Ernie Banks and then the city being able to come together and work together in one spirit.
Cheryl, how much of this was more about than just sports?
It was a lot more than just sports because, as you, the mentionings by President Obama, was the fact that all this happening on Martin Luther King's birthday and the significance of it, and Dexter Fowler being the first African-American to ever play for the Cubs in the World Series, and the fact that he is now playing for the Cardinals and he was with the team. That's why it was significant that they could have it not during the season, because otherwise it would be hard for him to, you know, be able to join them. So it was really a good moment for him to be there too.
And there were a couple of players who weren't there, and I wonder if there was a little bit of drama or awkwardness with, obviously, Todd Ricketts, the owner of the Cubs, was there. He was picked as Trump's Deputy Commerce Secretary. He was a Trump delegate for Illinois, a big supporter. Jake Arrieta opted out of visiting the White House. People might remember his tweet about ridiculing Clinton supporters. Was there any awkwardness there?
Well, I thought it was interesting because President Obama walked in holding Laura Ricketts' hand into the room. That's what I don't think was caught on camera. And because that was right by me. And she supported President Obama, and she was also the pro Hillary Clinton PAC.
Right, so that's leader. The Ricketts family member that he chose to walk in with. Right.
Yes. And Todd Ricketts, if you saw the visual of it, he was on the far end of the stage, which I thought that was very interesting to see.
Symbolic,
that.
Maybe, right, or just to avoid awkwardness.
Absolutely. You know, but Jake Arrieta not being there, he said over the weekend there was some family issues for illnesses. But John Lackey and John Lester not being there, the fact that they're all from the South, from Texas, you could draw your own conclusions. But I thought that was odd because they're all together there for the Cub convention.
So they couldn't
add one more day to the itinerary.
To go to the White House, sure.
Yeah.
Now, President Obama, he was in a really joking mood. He was poking fun of himself. He called Theo Epstein the best general manager the game has ever seen. What do you think that was like for Theo Epstein?
I talked to him afterwards. I asked him that, and he was just like, he just it made him so ecstatic to have that said to him by the president. But also have to add that Theo Epstein gave President Obama a pardon for being a Sox fan.
So. Well, and he also got lifetime. He got a lifetime pass to Wrigley Field, also, didn't he?
Right, and I thought the other funny quip was when President Obama said to Theo Epstein, "You're so great. Why don't you take over the chair of the DNC?"
Cheryl, what was it like for you? What was it like to be there at the White House?
This is the second time. I did it in February with the Blackhawks, and I did it yesterday with the Cubs. This was different. You knew that this was the last event for President Obama in his presidency, so you knew the significance of that. The room was full of just all Chicagoans, and it was a party atmosphere. They were singing Go Cubs Go, Go. There was just a lot of happiness. I talked to some of the aides, and they were telling me that most of the people had left, you know, they were gone, so they were on a very skeleton staff.
Well, I saw David Axelrod, which even popped up, right?
Yeah, David
Lisa
Axelrod.
Lisa Madigan was there, Attorney General. Yeah, lots of people.
Yeah, so it was a really loving, touching moment, you know, especially for a big Sox fan like President Obama to embrace the Cubs. That was really interesting.
Right. And I imagine also a little bit of finagling they had to do, because this isn't normally the time a team comes, right? I imagine there was a lot of schedule moving around to have the team visit while President Obama was still in office.
Well, the reason why they did it, too, is because they had the Cub convention, which all the players are there, so it was just adding on the next day. So it really wasn't as difficult as people may think. During the season, players that are on another team, like Dexter Fowler, could not have joined them. Like yesterday, Ben Zobras, who was with the Kansas City Royals when they won in 15, he could not join the Royals when the White House last year, but he could be there, you know, yesterday. So it actually worked out to the best before the team actually starts reporting for spring training in less than a month.
WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Raistout joining us one last time to talk about the historic Cubs World Series win. Cheryl, we'll have to have you on when the season starts, do another preview.
You got it.
But at least we've wrapped up this season well, right?
Sounds good.
Thanks, Cheryl.
Thank you.
A research team at Northwestern University has been studying the connection between exposure to violence and mental health issues such as post-traumatic stress disorder. Their new study examines how living in a disadvantaged neighborhood impacts the development of PTSD. And we're joined now by one of the lead authors of this study. Inger Burnett Ziegler is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor in the Department of Psychology and Behavioral Sciences at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. And she's with us now. Welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you initially set out to recruit women from a disadvantaged neighborhood in Chicago, all who had symptoms of depression, and you wanted them to participate in mindfulness-based training for depression. What did this involve?
What we were doing is we were looking to pilot test a mindfulness-based intervention for depression for adult women in an underserved community on the south side of Chicago. And we were looking to provide this treatment to these individuals and see how it impacted their depression and stress over time. As a part of that study, what we did was we assessed them for a number of different psychological conditions. And what we found is through that assessment, about 50% of them were reporting that they had significant histories of exposure to trauma. And so that led us to kind of dig into that a little bit more deeply and kind of explore what these traumatic experiences were related to. Additionally, the mindfulness intervention was an 8-week course in which the individuals came to a group for 8 weeks for 90 minutes per session. And these traumatic experiences often came up in the discussion throughout the course as individuals were talking about some of the things that were contributing to their current stress and struggle and depression. So it really became a pretty significant theme in terms of what these women were experiencing in their own lives and a factor that was related to their depression.
Was it surprising to you? Did you expect as you started doing this to find out, did you expect that when you were going in to do this mindfulness training that you would then find, as opposed to depression, trauma, and sort of all of these different links between violence and trauma and depression?
It was surprising in some sense. We did not set out to recruit individuals that had trauma experiences necessarily. So, and to then learn that, 50% had trauma experiences was surprising. By the same token, anxiety and depression, which PTSD is an anxiety disorder, those are highly correlated conditions. So to learn that individuals with depression were also suffering with some of these other psychological conditions was less surprising. I think what really stood out was how many people had been affected by violence personally in their families and in their communities, and then just their bravery and willingness to talk about it in the group setting. Mm-hmm. I want to add that the traumatic experiences that came up were not only related to violence, but also some individuals had past experiences of sexual trauma as well. Of those that had past traumatic experiences, it was about half that reported experiences related to violence, and then another half related to sexual or domestic violence. Mm.
When you talk about violence related to neighborhoods, gun violence, I wonder if you're thinking about that. I wonder how this is affecting people on a day-to-day basis. As you were going into this program to offer therapy to people, for these women that you were working with, how would this sort of affect them on a daily basis, these mental health issues?
Well, to start off, people were coming in because they wanted help with depression and stress. And I think that these traumatic experiences were direct contributors to those symptoms of depression and stress that they were experiencing. Additionally, people can have difficulty functioning, so they can have difficulty kind of doing their day-to-day chores, going to work, taking care of their families. They can find themselves distracted, having challenges kind of paying attention. They can feel more irritable, which can interfere with relationships with both family members and coworkers. They might have difficulty sleeping. So it really, impacts mood in a way that can impact pretty much everything people are trying to do and trying to accomplish on a day-to-day basis.
And what role does your mindfulness training play in helping to alleviate that?
What the mindfulness program does is, for one, it helps people to become more aware of both their thoughts and their physiological responses to stress. The first part of that can just be recognizing how you're responding to stress on a day-to-day basis and what those triggers for stress might be. So for somebody who has had a traumatic experience, it might be a significant anniversary, it might be a location or other reminders of the traumatic event that can lead to an increase in stress. And then the program will help people to kind of recognize what those triggers for increases in stress and anxiety are, and help them to use skills like breathing exercises, something that we call a body scan or a body visualization exercise, to change the ways in which their body is responding to those stressful triggers. And this is really important because, physiological responses to stress can have a direct impact in not only psychological conditions, but also in other chronic health conditions like cardiovascular disease. So giving people the tools to be able to kind of change their body's physical response to stress can be helpful in not only mental conditions, but also physical conditions.
And as you say that, I wonder then, how do you suggest, based on this study, what do you see as ways forward for helping people who are living in communities where violence, as you said, how you were so surprised, 51% of women from this neighborhood said they had experienced trauma. 71% of these traumatized women had symptoms of PTSD. That's compared to 20% in the general population. What do you suggest as ways forward for people who are living in these communities? What do you think are techniques that everyone can take with them?
You know, that's always a challenging question. You know, as mental health providers, we do try and give people the tools to be able to cope with stressful situations. But one of the kind of foundations for helping people to deal with, you know, some of these higher level issues is a sense of safety. And, you know, although I provide people with tools to kind of cope with stress and give them ways to independently deal with stress, I do think that it's a larger issue in helping people to be able to feel safe in their communities. And in these cases, unfortunately, they aren't safe. So with that said, I do think that screening is important and providing people resources in which they can get social support and resources in which they can get skills in order to deal with the factors that actually are in their control, such as these physiological responses. But I think more broadly, you know, we as a community need to be thinking about how to kind of make individuals feel more safe.
Inger Burnett Ziegler is a clinical psychologist. She's also an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. We'll tweet out a link to their new study so you can see a little bit more about it if you'd like to read it. Thank you so much for being with me, Inger.
Thank you for having me.
First is made possible by the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're interested in learning more about the human body, but maybe not so interested in curling up with a medical textbook on human anatomy or physiology, then a new book that's just out is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body might be for you. I'm joined now by its author, Jim Hamblin. He's a medical doctor turned journalist. He's going to be in Chicago tomorrow for a joint event with the Illinois Science Council and Matter. And he's with us now. Dr. Hamblin, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I think what I appreciated most about this is you start the book off with this interesting observation about ignorance, that it's actually something that's cultivated. And I wonder how you think the current atmosphere of information and the web and social media perpetuates this idea that ignorance is something that we're kind of all willfully cultivating.
Yeah. I spoke with this professor at Stanford who coined this term agnotology, sort of the study of the spread of ignorance. And not without getting too deeply into politics of the day, this is something that the classic textbook case is sort of the tobacco industry, where you didn't need to really combat the argument that tobacco or that cigarettes cause cancer. You just needed to sow doubt, to spread the idea that everybody has their own opinion and there's no real consensus. You know, everyone's entitled to their own idea about whether or not cigarettes cause cancer. So let's just go on smoking if you believe that it's safe. It was an ignorance to the idea that anything can be known. And so I think there's similar stuff going on today.
Well, and I think especially with health and medicine, right? And I think I always have these conversations with my doctor about like what I've looked up online and where the sources are. I think as a journalist, you as a journalist now, I should mention Jim is a medical doctor turned journalist. He's now a writer and senior editor at The Atlantic. We're looking at sources, right? That's part of what we do. But I think there's a lot of medical information out there that may be easily accessible and may not be great sources or understood. How much do you think that contributes to a lot of misinformation or confusion about, or even I think even marketing, right? The way products are marketed for being healthy. How much is that just sort of creates a really difficult environment to know what is accurate about our health?
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, and that's how the book is focused, as a lot of questions that I'm hearing frequently that people seem to be hearing conflicting messages on. And you'll often have an industry trying to tell you that, you know, something is part of a healthy lifestyle or part of a healthy diet, you know, like sugar, cereals or soda. And the medical community is just saying, no, there's, you know, you can survive eating these things occasionally, but that's not part of a healthy diet. So you're hearing conflicting messages, and then you go to whatever you're sort of looking to find on the internet. When you start Googling, especially with health stuff, you could find someone who will confirm what you were hoping to hear.
Right. Well, and I think, I mean,
on their blog. Sorry.
No, go ahead. There are blogs for everything. And I think there are all these forums where people post sort of every ridiculous worst case scenario of something. If you're looking up like a drug or a side effect or something like that. But when I think about that, I mean, I think you do this book topics, and we're going to get to there's a lot of topics in here that are great about our immune system and about nutrition and about our bodies and sex. But one thing that I think is a really kind of interesting question that is at the baseline of all of this is, and you talk about this, what's normal? And I think that's something that when it comes to our bodies, we tend to freak out about. How, I mean, and is there a way for us to figure out a gauge for that?
Yeah. It's a concept. The idea of normalcy is something that you need in science so that you can say, you know, most people end up having, say, blood pressures that are in this range, and therefore we will call blood pressure outside of this range too high or too low. But specifically, a lot of times when we're thinking about our appearances, a lot of times when it comes to matters of how we distinguish ourselves, draw lines between, you know, races, gender, sex, based on parts of our bodies, we hold up ideas of normalcy that I think often could be challenged. And it's helpful to think that, you know, maybe a lot of people happen to be a one-way clumping around a sort of median and a bell curve, but it doesn't mean that it is necessarily healthy or that being outside of it is right or wrong always.
So this book follows a Q&A type format. You write about health and medicine. I mentioned you get a lot of letters and emails from people who have questions about their body. Is that what inspired this book?
Yes, it did. I get so many questions from readers, from friends, from colleagues who just don't read or write as much about health and science. And so I figured if I could put them all in one book, then I could just refer people to that instead of having to repeat myself.
Right. I wonder I wonder if you could share, like, what are some of the strangest things you've been asked that maybe didn't end up in the book?
Oh, I think we purposefully put this strange ones in the book. So I'm having trouble.
Like, do a lot of people come up to you and say, why do men have nipples? Like, I feel like these are kind of odd questions.
Yeah, that one is actually based on, so the entire idea of a book is sort of a send up of this mini genre of health trivia books. And there actually was a book titled Why Do Men Have Nipples?
That was the bestseller, right?
In here. Yeah, it was a very widely well-received book, and I wanted to take that genre and explore the depth behind the trivia. So not very few of these answers are extremely pithy and straightforward dinner party conversation, but get into the bigger ideas about why. The more interesting thing to me about nipples is that it is fundamentally the same structure in men and women, developed at the same point in our embryological development. And yet societally, we treat them in very, very different ways. It's illegal to publicly display female nipples in some states in America.
Yeah, it's interesting, and there is a whole interesting description, and there's a whole court case that you talk about in the book. You know, you, and I think it is, there is an interesting point about how you answer a lot of common, maybe not so common questions people have, but you also address, I think, some of the overlooked structural issues that are also tangled in with this, right? And I think you just alluded a little bit to that, talking about the way women and men are treated differently in terms of nudity. But what do you I feel like you talk, there's affordable health care, homelessness, the environment. I wonder, when we think about health care and our bodies and health, what do you think is the most overlooked structural issue we're not really paying attention to right now?
You know, for all that it seems like we hear about food, about diet, and it's people trying to modify their diet to lose weight, I think it's talking about access to high quality food and the agricultural system that is going to produce that food and bring it to people, and how our subsidies for what we produce in this country are not arranged to have everyone have easy, cheap access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And I think there are just huge gains to be made when you look at the what some would call an epidemic of cardiometabolic disease in this country, with over half of people having some form of either being obese or overweight, as according to the latest numbers. So if you're looking to for the sort of lowest hanging fruit, I think that's still the biggest ground to be gained is in the food supply.
I'm talking with Jim Hamblin. He's a medical doctor. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His new book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. And Jim, you know, when you mentioned food and nutrition, that is, I think it's something people kind of perk up about when you talk about that. I want to ask you about milk, because this is, you talk about this, this is for, I think a lot of people, Americans, were growing up, we have been told repeatedly, you know, that you have to drink milk, that it makes you healthy and strong. There were all the commercials in the 80s, the milk, it does a body good campaign, which is probably sort of one of those campaigns that gets ingrained into little kids' minds. Is that true?
It certainly was ingrained in my mind. And then there was the Got Milk campaign with everyone having
all the celebrities
mustaches. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that there was federal funding that went into subsidizing that campaign, because we subsidized the dairy industry. And it turns out that there's nothing in milk that is not very easily accessible through fruits and vegetables and many other ways of getting these things. Usually people say calcium, vitamin D, and phosphorus, things that you need. Also, it's a good source of protein. But if you parse that, what's being sold to you there, they're just saying it's a good source of these nutrients, not it's the only source. And it turns out that within our food system, if you're just eating a bunch of white bread, peanut butter, and jelly sandwiches, then yes, it is good to add milk to that. But if you're eating a whole plant-based diet, then there's no need for milk.
Right. And, so the idea is to look at, sort of to look beyond that, right? That milk, the important thing about milk is that it's a source of calcium and vitamin D, and maybe look for that from other places too?
Yes, it is indeed an excellent source of those things, but it is far from the only one.
And I feel like you have this whole section on carbs versus fat versus diet trends. And I feel like this is also tough for people, lay people who are looking at this stuff, because there's always studies, there's always different headlines about this is good for you, this is not good for you, you should eat this, no, you shouldn't eat this. All the nutrition experts you've spoken with over the years, all the reporting you've done, is there anything that you think all nutrition experts would agree upon in terms of what we should be eating?
That's the big question. And I get into that in this book. I went to this conference where they purposely brought together a bunch of people who've sort of studied disparate areas of research, Mediterranean diet and the paleo dieting and veganism and standard American diet. No one was really advocating for that, but you know, have focused
what
on.
What is that? What is the standard American diet? What does that mean?
You know, well, what we have.
Does
right
that mean
now,
McDonald's? That's what it sounds like you're saying.
Very high in processed carbs, very high in meat and dairy compared to the rest of the world, and very low in fiber and very high in added sugar. So you're more, when you're studying that, you're just looking at, you know, how is this hurting us? So anyway, the groups, people who have generally different conclusions sat down together, and what they, you generally can agree on minimally processed plant-based diet. So whole plants, a lot of them. Very few people are going to say, in fact, I can't think of anyone who I've spoken to who would say, no, don't do that. You know, there's
Dr. Atkins
on how much. Yeah, there's disagreement on how much meat and protein people should have for optimal health. I don't think even Dr. Atkins wouldn't have told people to avoid fruits and vegetables, to my knowledge.
But that brings me to another question that you ask, which I really liked, which is, why do people crave terrible food late at night? Why do we think want things like pizza or sugary things?
Yeah, that was a question that came to me, and it seems that when your body is shutting down for the evening, it is there are hormonal fluctuations that make you sort of go into relaxed mode, being ready to sleep. And when you don't sleep, your low blood sugar tells you, you need to eat something. Whereas normally you need a low blood sugar while you're sleeping because you're not up and active and moving around. You might have to be supplying your body with energy. So if you go past that point where you should have gone to bed, people tend to want, I guess, what Taco Bell would sell to you as the fourth meal. So people who are chronically sleep deprived end up gaining weight. And eating more is just one of the reasons that happens.
One thing that I also think is a really interesting thing is cold weather, and how I feel like when it's cold, people tend to crave carbs more, or they want sort of, is that true, or is there any scientific basis to that? And I only say this as someone who was a native Floridian who moved to the Midwest and found that during the polar vortex, I would consume things like Chicago deep dish pizza, which I would never, ever otherwise eat.
That's really interesting. I know that when you are cold, your body is burning more calories you're constantly maintaining yourself at 98.6 degrees. So when it's cold outside, you have to get the fuel to create that energy from somewhere.
No one's ever asked you that question before? I'm shocked.
No, I've not heard it. That's impressive. I can look more into it, but I know that if you're actually spending time outside in the cold weather, it makes sense that you would be hungrier because that uses more energy. But when you're out in the cold weather, your body is burning energy in order to maintain its core temperature, so it would make sense that you would be hungrier.
My guest is Jim Hamblin. He's a medical doctor. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His new book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. He has an event coming up in Chicago tomorrow. It's a joint event with the Illinois Science Council and Matter. If you're in the Chicago area and want to attend, we'll tweet out all the info for that. Follow us on Twitter at 21stshow. You can also find that information on our website, 21stshow.org. By the way, our Twitter account, we live tweet during the show with more analysis, background information, like I just said, on what we talk about. When we're not on the air, that's where we're tweeting out information about Illinois news. On our Facebook page, if you search for the 21st to Like It, you can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Jim Hamblin. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Dr. Jim Hamblin. He's a doctor, a senior editor at The Atlantic. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. He's actually going to be speaking in Chicago tomorrow. He's got a joint event with the Illinois Science Council and Matter. We'll tweet out more details for that. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We'll have all the links to where you can find him, as well as at our website, 21stshow.org. Jim, so I want to get into some more specific questions that we talked about here. We were just talking about nutrition and food, and there's a good section on hydration, which I think is the problem is with all of these medical things is everyone has these rules of thumb that they hear about, right? And the one, whether it's milk or whether it's a marketing campaign that gets ingrained as a rule of thumb, like that we should be drinking milk or we should be drinking 8 glasses of water a day. Is that true or false?
Yeah, that's so interesting because when you talk to hydration researchers, scientists, they tend to say that actually upsets a lot of people because it's pretty arbitrary and your hydration needs are totally dependent on where you are, the weather, how active you are, your own personal functioning of your kidneys. So. To make a rule like that can upset some people. But then when you get into behavioral psychology, it turns out that it actually helps a lot of people to have a concrete, simple thing to shoot for. And that just saying something like drink more water or try to drink a good amount of water
doesn't help. But if you say 8 glasses, it does.
Exactly.
Oh, that's
exactly.
Interesting.
So I have to say it's a reasonable rule of thumb, but it is pretty arbitrary.
Well, and it's interesting you say that because we've done programs on this, and I remember we got a lot of calls of people who were really upset because of one thing one of our guests said about the amount of water that they drank, and this was a professional marathon runner, but people were really upset because they said people can overhydrate, and that's very dangerous too. So what's sort of a good rule of thumb for monitoring whether or not, I mean, we all have different sizes. As you said, it's metabolism. For me, it's the size of my bladder. I mean, what do you think it is in terms of how much water we should be drinking?
Yeah. What I was told in investigating this answer is often urine color is a good one, that you should be going for clear to light yellow urine. So obviously that does not prevent the problem of overhydration, we do read about it in marathoners and in fraternity pledges who are forced to chug a gallon of water in half an hour. But in real life, it's extremely hard to do. There are psychiatric disorders where people become compulsive about drinking water.
Probably so also it pretty rare, I would imagine, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's very hard. If you're you have to kind of be very forcibly trying to drink as much water as you can in order for it to be a real problem.
But it is interesting when you think about news coverage, and I'm going to throw media coverage in there, of how that impacts what we think about health and medicine. And in particular, I thought it was fascinating. You write about this, the fear that people have of sharks. But when we think about how sharks, how many people they kill a year worldwide based on how many, for example, people die from mosquito bites. I mean, how much of this is, again, I think, because of sort of the culture that we're surrounded with, or, you know, movies like Jaws?
Yeah. Yeah. I think media, entertainment media plays a huge, huge part in this. And the sort of visceral fear of a shark tearing into your flesh is so much worse than a mosquito, which is killing so many people every year by spreading malaria and is, in fact, the thing that we're all much more likely to suffer by and should be concerned with.
You have a really interesting section about itches, speaking of this, and I wanted to ask you about this. You talk about there's one theory as to why our sensory systems have evolved to the point that scratching an itch is something that is pleasurable, right? And it may have something to do with the fact that mosquitoes are, as you're saying, very deadly. What's the link?
Yeah, so why would we itch? You know, it's one of those times that you're actually destroying or removing some dead skin cells from yourself, but to no clear purpose. So people have theorized, and one of the leading theories is that it has to do with insects and the infectious diseases that they spread, and that we are meant to get them off of us when we feel them, and that it makes more sense for us to have a low threshold for sensing an insect. So go ahead and scratch, even if there probably is nothing there, as opposed to waiting until you're feeling the bite before you react to it. So that's why we're constantly scratching ourselves all the time. At least that's one idea. It's a very complex and bizarre phenomenon, as straightforward as it, or as little thought as we tend to give it.
Well, and as I say this, you also talk about the fact that people who are listening to you talk about itching may notice they're scratching right now. The producers and our engineer in our control room are all saying that they're feeling very itchy. But you write about that too, right? That if you if you listen to people talking about itching, you may notice yourself becoming itchy. And I guess would you say that's a psychosomatic thing?
There certainly is an element of social and psychological component to scratching ourselves and to perceiving itch. And that leads to it's a pretty big section in the book, but the chronic itch is a problem for a lot of people. And it has for a long time been chalked up to psychiatric symptom, or when doctors can't find any organic clear cause of this. So right now you're seeing some medical centers spring up in around the country. There's a center just on curing and treating chronic itch. There's one at Washington University in St. Louis. There's one at Temple in Philadelphia. And so I talked to people at both of these places, and they told me just about the maze of science that's going into trying to understand all the things that can make us itch.
My guest is Jim Hamblin. He's a medical doctor turned journalist. He's a writer. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. One big question that I think, especially this time of year when everyone's really sick, is about our immune system. And I was on the street in Chicago before the holidays, and there was, I will not say the name of a company, they were passing out big boxes of cough drops that were immune. They were like, these are immune boosting cough drops, and it's all echinacea, and it's going to be great. And I took them all throughout the holidays and then told everybody I didn't get sick because I think I had all these little immuno boosts that I was taking. Can you really, I guess even before I ask, can you boost your immune system? I probably should ask you, what is our immune system?
That is a great question, because for so long we defined systems in the body by structures, by the nervous system being the brain and the spinal cord, and the gastrointestinal system being the stomach and the gut, and musculoskeletal system being so obvious. And then you have the immune system, which is sort of everywhere throughout us, not just our white blood cells, but the skin is the primary barrier in the immune system, which keeps pathogens out. And then we're learning of all these bacteria that form the microbiome, and other microbes that form the microbiome that live inside and on us, that are creating a sense of harmony with these pathogenic disease-causing microbes, and that it is all really this grand balance of most of the systems in our body that are trying to have us not be infected by some invading agent. So then to say that, simply a vitamin C supplement or echinacea is going to protect you from any particular one of these things is a vast oversimplification, and probably not dangerous to take, but it's no good to see people wasting their money on things, or if you have a false sense of security and then you feel like you should go hang out with somebody who's got a cold and you're not going to get sick,
or not get your flu shot because you're like, oh, I drink a lot of vitamin C.
Yes. That's the worst example, because many people die every year of the flu. It's not to be taken lightly, and flu shots are far from perfect, but worth getting.
Jim, are you someone who's super skeptical then about all of these, any kind of marketing that you see for vitamins or now we've seen all of these immune system, like sort of the whole notion of probiotics, which I think is something that's new and not very well understood, at least not from a lay, certainly not from a lay perspective. And it seems to be sort of a new growing edge of science and health. How do you approach all of these things?
Well, yeah, to go off probiotics, I think that is just something that everyone is going to have a careful eye on in coming years, because it's getting so big so quickly, and we know so little about anything that is actually effective in this realm, or that would be effective for all people, given that we're all very, very different, and the microbes that inhabit us are very, very different from one person to the next. So they're regulated as dietary supplements as opposed to pharmaceuticals. So you can put them on the market without proof that they do anything. And you can make claims that strongly imply that your product does something like boost the immune system without evidence for that. So then it's on the consumer to go back and try to figure out what's what. So I tend to... Be very skeptical of all that stuff, and I know it's tough to point people to any particular resource as to know what works and what doesn't. But hopefully, having some sort of relationship with a doctor or other expert who can try to parse out some of these marketing claims, I think that's really worthwhile.
And what's your best advice for when you're doing your own research, as opposed to, as you said, have a good relationship with a health professional? But when you people who are doing their own research, what's sort of your best advice for people to have good critical thinking and be able to evaluate whether or not something is a good source of information from a health perspective or a medical perspective online?
Well, if you're just reading lay media, I think that's something that's useful for everybody to be good at evaluating what is reasonable journalism and what seems like it's just trying to sell a product. So are you hearing downsides to the product? Are you hearing someone who seems to be approaching this with a strong degree of skepticism? Are you hearing that this has been studied in a lot of people for a long time? It's easy to make news stories out of people who ate a piece of chocolate every day for a week and ended up having higher levels of energy. But we don't, that's really not meaningful in the long term. And so yeah, length of time, number of people, and then does it seem like you're getting a full picture of skepticism in the story?
You know, we're almost out of time, but I had one last question for you, which is unfortunately kind of a big one. Can we even determine what healthy is, do you think?
I think it's important that people have an understanding of what healthy means to them, and that you're not shooting for something that's unattainable given the physical circumstances and social circumstances of your life, and that you're happy, and that people realize that life it comes with sickness and disease, and it ends in death for all of us. It's a sad note to end the interview on, but the whole last section of the book is about death and dying, and something that we don't like to talk about in this country. But how many people's later years could be so much better
if we did, right?
More meaningful, mm-hmm. if we did.
Yeah. Well, Jim is going to be talking about all of this tomorrow in Chicago. Again, we'll tweet out all of those details if you're interested in going to that, if you're in the Chicago area. Right now, I want to thank Jim Hamblin. He's a doctor. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm afraid that's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us, whether it's phone, email, or social media, is all at our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on the air, lots of news and information about Illinois. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Haula Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.